And I suppose in some ways that's this morning, looking at Exodus, moving on into Exodus, kind of like to tie, if we're getting a scope of history, I like to give like a quick little tie-in from the past. So we talked about Joseph last week. I spent some time this week just trying to say, okay, let's see if we nail down the how that ties in with the Egyptian history. When did this happen and so on? Well, the problem with Egypt, the problem with Egyptian history is the Egyptians did not record things that were not good for them. They were very careful. You heard the phrase, the winners write the history? I think the Egyptians invented that. They just would erase someone. If one pharaoh did not like the previous pharaoh, they would actually go in and erase his name off monuments and wipe out any record of this previous pharaoh and rewrite history that way. So we don't have a clear statement of when Joseph came to Egypt or when the Israelites left. But we certainly can get the background. There's a couple options. And if the option I think is probably correct, the earlier option, if you are familiar with history, would have Joseph coming to Egypt at the very height of Egyptian power. And the Pharaoh Amenhotep, Egyptian name's great. One thing the history sees is this Pharaoh begins and all the noblemen have a lot of power. And Pharaoh's, he's the king, he's the leader of Egypt, but really the real power rests with the nobleman. Kind of like the feudal system of medieval Europe, where the nobleman had as much power or nearly as much as the king. And then by the end of his reign, he has complete power. And he is the absolute authority with no questions asked. And he's undermined all the noblemen that could have hurt him. And so it looks like probably what's gone on there is Joseph's coming, because if you read the story, Joseph taxes the grain of the Egyptians, 20%, and then he no doubt buys up grain, and then as the years of famine come, he ends up buying all the livestock of the Egyptians, then all their land, then them themselves, and essentially Pharaoh owns the entire thing. By the time Joseph is done, by the time the famine's over. So we've got that little tie-in with history of this Pharaoh who comes to absolute power with no real reason for it that historians can see. So anyway, so we know that Joseph came. Later on, there were foreign powers that came in and took over the northern part of Egypt, up around the Nile Delta. And so with that history going on, that's no doubt what's behind that little phrase, there arose a Pharaoh that did not know Joseph, because there's Semitic, Canaanite-type people now that are ruling part of Egypt, and there's this power struggle. And so the Israelites get caught in the middle of this power struggle. And so Pharaoh at that point says, these people could overthrow us, especially, and this is putting history and scripture together, especially if they were to ally with the Hyksos, these rulers of the north that were not Egyptian. And so thus Pharaoh decides, we've got to do something to undermine these foreigners' power that are in our midst, because we are weak. We could be destroyed by them if they were to ally with these other northern rulers. So he enslaves the Israelites. We know the story. He enslaves the Israelites as a protection against them possibly revolting and fighting against him. And Moses, of course, is born. We know that story as well. We're not going to spend time there. He's born. He's placed in the ark of bulrushes in the Nile. He grows up in the very court of Pharaoh. Now, again, if we got the history right, we know the treasures from King Tut's tomb, one of the small... Actually, the reason they didn't find it is he was one of the pharaohs that he was erased afterwards. And so they didn't know he existed until they found his tomb. But we saw the incredible treasure. I don't know how many went through the St. Louis Museum when they had the King Tut exhibit there. Phenomenal amounts of gold, phenomenal amounts of wealth in this minor pharaoh's tomb. If I have the history right in my understanding, that's after the plagues. So this is already Egypt that's been decimated and struggling, and yet that level of lavish wealth is still present. Can you imagine what it would have been at Joseph's time, at the height of Egyptian power, or even at Moses' time, as we still have this incredible, incredibly wealthy, strong nation. He's raised up. He's raised in the middle of luxury, of opulence, of the greatest, the greatest teaching, the greatest court in the world at the time. And he's there, raised as a prince of Egypt. Well, the problem is he has a temper. We see that periodically through his life. Moses had a temper that proved in several ways his undoing. I remember later in the wilderness when God says, speak to the rock. And he, instead of speaking to the rock, he chews out the Israelites for a little bit and then hits the rock. And because of that, what seems to be a minor disobedience, but God, knowing what's going on, says, okay, you disobeyed. You are not entering the promised land. The whole goal of Moses' life through that time was to enter Canaan. And because of his temper, God says, no, you're not crossing over. Moses had a temper. And the temper showed up fairly early. We can see Moses almost, he sees himself, he's in the perfect position to free his people. He identifies as an Israelite, but he's raised in the royal court, so he has the influence, he has the power, or he will as he grows, have the power to help his people. And yet he still identifies as an Israelite. And so he sees an Egyptian beating an Israelite, and he steps in and his temper takes over, and instead of just stopping him, he kills him. Right there. Hides him. Not known. In the next day, he sees two Israelites fighting. And he stops, tries to step in there as well. He's the prince. And he's an Israelite. He's going to straighten this out. And they respond, and kill me too. And he flees. He flees west across the Sinai Peninsula to Midian. He goes to Midian. Now, in Midian, he meets another story. We know the story. He meets the daughter of Jethro and marries the daughter of Jethro, the priest of Midian. And scholars don't know whether that's... Midian is descended from Abraham. So Jethro may have been a priest of God, may have actually been teaching the true God. He may have been a pagan priest. We don't know. There's not enough details from history or from the Bible to know whether he's a pagan priest or a godly priest. But Moses goes there. He gets in with a man, an established man in Midian, a well-known, influential man, and he ends up tending his sheep, tending his flock. Spends 40 years in Egypt, flees at 40 or about 40. He spends another 40 years tending the flock of his father-in-law. Okay, from prince of Egypt to your father-in-law's sheep keeper. That's quite a letdown. So Moses is a failure. By any measure that we can place on his life at this point, he is a failure. He blew the opportunity God gave him because he got mad. He blew the train. He blew everything about his life. And now he's just keeping sheep for somebody else for 40 years. He's really turned away from his Egyptian identity. Because we know from the story of Joseph, Egyptians hated shepherds. One of Egypt's gods was a ram-headed god, so they felt that sheep, that rams especially, were sacred. So someone that raised rams to use their wool and to eat, that would have been heretical. And so that's one of the reasons Egyptians hated shepherds. And so now Moses has become a thorough non-Egyptian, all right? He's a shepherd all the way through. And as he's going out, and he's apparently taking the flock quite a ways to find grass, to find pasture. Because if you look at the map, Midian is west, is southwest of Egypt. Sinai, Mount Horeb, Mount of God, which is where he was, Sinai is northeast of Midian. So it's quite a long ways. It is a long way from Midian up to Mount Sinai. So he's taking, maybe there's a famine in Midian. Maybe grass wasn't available there. It was a fairly desert region. We don't know for sure. But he takes this flock to Sinai to find pasture. So he's there at Sinai just finding grazing for his father-in-law's flock. And we know the story again. He sees a bush, and in my mind, he's probably seeing a flame and assumes it's a, you know, it's grazing land, so it's a campfire from other shepherds somewhere, and then he gets closer and sees, no, it's a bush. That's a little weird. And then he says, wait a minute, this bush has been on fire for a long time. It should have burned out by now. The bush apparently was an acacia bush, a thorny, hard, dry bush typically. So it wouldn't have been that unusual for it to catch fire from ashes from a campfire or something, but it's just burning. So he says, okay, this is weird. Fire is not that unusual, but a bush that's burning and not burning up, that is unusual. That's strange. Let's go see what's going on. And then he draws near, and God says to him, Moses, Moses. Why did he bring his name twice? It's actually a Hebrew endearment. It's something you say to a friend, to someone who's, it's not a formal, hey, Moses. It's a, my friend, Moses. My beloved, Moses. It's something you use to someone with whom you have a close relationship. When God called Samuel, it was the same thing, Samuel. Samuel, when David was mourning for Absalom, in many cases he repeats his name twice. It's an ingrained Hebrew expression of affection. So God is calling Moses, essentially at this point saying, Moses, even though you think you're a failure, I still love you. I still have a relationship with you. And Moses responds, probably hesitantly, here I am. I'm listening. And God, the first thing God does is start teaching about holiness. He says, don't come near. Stay where you are. Don't draw any closer. Take off your shoes. This is holy ground. It's where God is. Pagans, the idea of holiness in paganism, in pagan worship, is simply go through the rituals. Keep the gods happy. Now, things are the gods, but there's no real, there's nothing, you know, some things belong to the gods, but holiness is not really an idea in paganism. And of course, Moses has grown up in Egyptian paganism. He's grown up around Midian. Whether or not Jethro was a priest of God or not, there was certainly paganism throughout Midian. Many of those concepts leach in even into God's people. And so the first thing God says is, I need you to understand what holiness is. If we were to shift forward in the story, we'd find out God spending a lot of time teaching his people what holiness is. Many of the strange commands in Leviticus in the Old Testament are designed as object lessons to teach what holiness is. So the first thing God says is, you have to understand holiness. Old Testament, holiness meant stay off. Old Testament, it was back off. You don't come close to God's holiness. We see this in the burning bush here. Stay where you are. Don't come closer. We see at Mount Sinai, when God comes to Sinai, he says, put a fence around, mark an area around this mountain. Don't come close to it. We see in the tabernacle, in the temple, you did not enter that without washing at the laver. And even then, you didn't enter unless you were a priest. And the holiest part, only the high priest goes once a year. Holiness is an arm. It's distance in the Old Testament. And it's easy to still feel that way. And we need to have that aura of respect, of awesomeness, of understanding God's awesomeness. But the reality is, in the New Testament, that totally changes. Because when Christ died, that temple veil was ripped in half. As a way of saying, holiness is no longer something, stay off there. You get yourself perfect before you enter, before you come close to God. You've got to be sure you've cleansed yourself, you've got to be sure you're wearing the right thing, you've got to be sure you've got to do all the steps of the ritual first, and then you can come to God. But in the New Testament, and God's holiness is a wide open arm saying, join me. Join me and share my character. Incredible change in understanding of what holiness is from this time. But the first thing he has to do is teach Moses what holiness is. Then God commands. He gives a command to Moses. He says, I want you to go back to Egypt and free my people. I've seen their affliction. I've seen their struggle. I've seen their suffering. I want you to go back. Now, if we're right that Moses saw himself as the deliverer of Israel from the first, then we have this situation. Moses is now 80 years old. In that day, an 80-year-old is not quite the same as today. They lived about 120, but Moses did anyway. But it's not a young man, even in that day. All right, so here's Moses. His life is pretty well set. He's accomplished nothing. So if he ever saw himself, and he probably did, as the deliverer of Israel, he doesn't anymore. He's given that up. He's let that dream die. And so now God says, okay, Moses, now that you are through and a failure and no longer have any interest in fulfilling your dreams, now is time for you to go deliver Israel. And so when we understand Moses at this point has given up on life, on accomplishing anything, as far as we can tell, we understand his responses a little better. God says, I'm going to send you to Egypt. And Moses says, who am I? Hey, I could have done that when I was a prince of Egypt, but now I'm a shepherd. I'm nobody. Who am I that I should go to talk to Pharaoh and tell him to let God's people go? Moses has five objections through this passage. We're moving fairly quickly here. But there's five times Moses says, God, you've got it wrong. And the first thing he says is, I'm not important enough. I don't have the status. I don't have the strength. Who am I that I should go? And God says, look, hold on. I'm going with you. Every objection Moses gives is, I'm not good enough, or I'm not able, or I have something. And every response God gives is, yes, but I can. Yes, but I will be with you. Moses' view was all about himself. I think he is probably living in self-pity. And we see it coming out here. He lost his place in Egypt. He's watching somebody else's sheep. And now God talks to him. He's like, no, I can't do that. But God says, no, I'm going with you. Well, later on, that's enough for Moses. Later on, he says to God, look, if you're not with us, don't send us. You've got to be with us. At this point, we're seeing Moses at a low point, a very low point in life. So God says, I'm going to go with you. And Moses is like, well, okay, but who are you? He says, if I go and tell them God sent me, then they're going to say, who is he, really? What's his name? And God responds, I am who I am. Or actually the way the Hebrew expression is, it's best we can tell because it's long story there, but it has a causal effect. It's not just I am who I am, but I am the one that causes. I am the base of why everything exists. So it's not just I'm who I am, and don't ask me more questions. It's I'm the one who creates. I'm the one who causes things. I'm the one in control. I am the sovereign. I am, and some who are trying to be more technical with the Hebrew would say I am / cause. All right, I'm the source of all things. Say this to them, I am has sent me. And he goes on to say, tell them I am the God of Abraham, of Isaac, the God of Jacob. I'm the one who's traced your family history, brought you to this place. He says, this is my name forever. This is how I am to be remembered forever. Not putting it up, not going through it right now, but if you read through this passage of Scripture, God spends quite a while explaining not only who he is, but what he's going to do. You're going to go there, and he's not going to let you go, and I'm going to send plagues, and they're going to come out, and they're going to have wealth from their Egyptians, and I'm going to bring them into... And this very detailed response to Moses saying, essentially, who are you? That's a question God loves to answer. When God says, I'm with you, and we say, yeah, but who are you? And maybe it's phrased a different way, all right? But when we want to know more of God, he is delighted to respond. It may not always be. It's not usually through words, but it can be in his word. As we read, we're saying, God, I want to know more of who you are, what you're like, and we'll find in his word. It may be through preaching. It may be through a friend saying something. It may be through situations, but God delights to tell us who he is. Moses said, I don't really know who you are. And God says, let me tell you who I am. I'll tell you something that's going to be remembered forever, that I am the I am. Moses 3 says, but they're not going to believe me. They'll say, God did not send you. And here God says, okay, Moses, what's in your hand? Now understand, that's usually and often applied as whatever's in your hand, just use what you have. That's accurate. But if we actually take the big picture of the story, this is the first time Moses' staff appears, okay? But you think about what he, but first of all, in that day, for the shepherds especially, for the Canaanite or Semitic people, a staff is more than a staff. It's not just a stick you walk with. A staff is your identity. In fact, there are times when God was saying, let me show you who I've chosen to be priests. And God told Moses, have all the leaders of the tribes bring their staff and lay it, and then whichever one will actually bear fruit and blossom, that's the one I've chosen. So they bring their staffs as a marker of their identity, of their authority. Scripture refers to breaking the staff of something, as in breaking their power. The staff in that culture is important. It's not just a stick. Yes, it is. It's a shepherd's stick. But it has the idea of authority, of power, of even identity in that staff. So when he says, what do you have? It's not just whatever happens in your hand, all right? And if you want to apply it that way, that's fine. It's a good lesson. But the idea is not just whatever happens in your hand. It's you're going to take your staff, what you use all the time, what you invest yourself with, the authority you have or you think you don't have, who you are, that's what I'm going to use. And we can look at the staff. In fact, one writer said the staff almost becomes a character in the story because he brings his staff back and he throws it down. God tells him, throw down the staff. It becomes a snake. And Moses runs. And God said, now pick up the snake by the tail. And anybody knows snakes knows you don't pick them up by the tail, right? Well, he goes back to Egypt, and his staff is what he's using over and over for miracles in Egypt. Aaron's staff as well, and maybe there's the same staff, whoever happened to have it. There's a debate on that. But the staff becomes a tool, an instrument. Come to the Red Sea. He lifts up his staff over the Red Sea, and it opens. He strikes the rock with his staff, and the water comes out. In the battle against Amalek, when the Israelites were failing, Moses praying raises his staff. And we know that story again. And the Israelites prevail as long as his staff is raised. The staff becomes very, very important in the story as a symbol, as a tool of God's help. And so right here, God says, what's in your hand? God, Moses is like, my staff. Probably don't think anything of it. It's just a stick he uses. But it's who he is wrapped up in symbol. And God says, I have plans for what you've already written off. Let me just pause there a second. Don't write yourself off too quick. It's easy to do. You know your failures, your weaknesses, your struggles better than anybody else. And it's really tempting to look it over and say, you know what, I can't do that much. And write yourself off. Or write off what talents God has given you. Or write off whatever it is. There's two errors we can fall into, not just in the Christian life, in life, but certainly Christian life as well. One is the error of pride that says, I'm good enough to do it on my own. I'm the best, I'm the strongest, I'm whatever. The other error is also just as wrong to say, I'm no good. It's still an absorption with myself. And when you say, I have nothing, God can't use me because I've got nothing. That's not humility. That's pride in reverse, if you will. But when you say, yeah, I've got nothing, but I'm giving it to God anyway. I may have nothing to offer, but whatever I do have is his. That's where humility comes from. So God says to Moses, throw down your staff, it becomes a serpent. Then he goes ahead and says, okay, a couple more signs for you. You want to prove who sent you? Put your hand inside your coat. Pull it out. It's full of leprosy. Well, a serpent was something the Egyptians were very familiar with, water snakes and so on. Many of the gods were understood to send disease and heal disease. A lot of prayers to pagan gods were for healing from diseases. So God is saying, I have the power over disease. I have the power to create life with a snake. I have the power over disease. Then he says, and then if that doesn't work, take water from the Nile, pour it out to become blood. What's he saying there? In symbol again. He says, I have power over the gods of Egypt. Egypt, the Nile, they worship the Nile as a god. And he said, I'm going to show power over the gods of Egypt, power over the plagues that are coming. So Moses says, they're not going to believe me. God says, I'll leave that with me. I can handle that. I can convince them. Fourth objection. He said, I'm not eloquent. I can't talk. There we have that more of that probably a self-pity or, man, if I could just talk better, I could. If I had the voice, if I had the silver tongue, I could do so much more. But God, I can't do it because I can't talk. Whatever it is in your life, you're thinking, I can't do much of anything for God because I can't do whatever. You'd be amazed what God can do for you. And God says to him, don't worry about that. Notice, again, everything Moses says is about himself. I can't. And God says, yeah, but I can. I've got it taken care of. Lord says, who made your mouth? I could have given you a better mouth if I wanted to. I gave you the mouth I gave you because I wanted you to have that mouth. Now you'll use that mouth for me. All right, that's not quite literal translation, but it's close enough. Right? Who made your mouth? You're telling me I did a bad job on your mouth, Moses. Yeah. You go and I will take care of it. I made you. I'll help you. I'm with you. Then the fifth objection. Moses says, and the King James here, and actually it's probably more literal than the ESV here, is send by whoever you will send. What he means is anybody but me. All right? So the English Standard here goes a little more less literal and says, oh my Lord, please send someone else. Well, that's what he meant. Anybody but me. So he's moved from, yeah, but I can't, to just saying, I don't want to. No, not me. And that's why the next verse says the anger of the Lord was kindled. Because God is incredibly patient when we're struggling, when we're hesitating, when we're saying, God, I can't. I'd like to, but I can't. But when we get to that point of saying, I just don't want to, things change. And God says, no, that's forbidden territory, Moses. All right, you're beyond just struggling with, and I understand struggle, and I understand God would say, I understand what you're going through, and I can help you through it. But when you just sit there and say, no, I just don't want to, you've entered a new territory with that. So the anger of the Lord is kindled, and he says, all right. Now, and again, whether this was almost a punishment, okay, Aaron will share the glory, quote unquote, or whether it was, okay, even though you're, and I think more accurately, even though, Moses, now you're just not wanting to do it, I will still help you with it. All you have to do is come, is trust me. I could have done it through you alone, but since you're just not wanting that, I'll let Aaron step in and help you. There's accommodation, there's anger, there's accommodation, because I think, I'm convinced, it's not a rebellious thing of Moses saying, no, I will not do this. It's still a deep, I mean, Moses has 40 years of heartache to work through here. And even though what he said was, I don't want to go, and that was wrong to say, God is still saying, I will help you. And I'll even give you help you don't need, essentially. If you follow the story of Moses, Aaron did the speaking at first for a little while. Then we see Aaron and Moses. And before too long, Moses is doing his own talking. Basically, he said, okay, I'll give you Aaron as a crutch to help you, but you don't really need it. God will meet us where we are. Aaron can help you. So then this is Moses basically at his worst. He's an 80-year-old man. He's given up on his hopes, his dreams, his aspirations. He's a failure. And apparently he's drowning in self-pity. But even at this point, notice he's honest with God. He's saying, I can't. He's being genuinely honest with God. Now, that's not all it takes. I often emphasize that we need to be honest with God because we do, number one. And because number two, it's so easy not to be. We seem to think if we get the words right, if we just sound right, if God wants us to just play the part and then catch up with reality later. God values honesty, and God responds to Moses' honesty, but he still has to get to the place where he's saying, okay, excuses are done, and I'm going to step forward with you. Honesty is not enough. It's invaluable. It's necessary, but there has to be action as well. He had to get past excuses and step forward. From this point on, we don't see Moses wavering. We don't see him still ever again struggling with, I can't do it. We see him growing into his role to some extent. We see him attacked. We see him threatened, undermined, complained against, maneuvered against with people behind his back saying, well, we should be helping as well, and so on. We see him lose his temper and pay for it. But we see him because of this, I can't do it, but God can. We see him intercede and God spares the entire nation. We see him inspire people. We see him as the lawgiver of Israel. We see him receive the incredible privileges of seeing God, of talking to God face to face, of seeing God, not his face, but of his back, essentially, in symbol. When we give up our excuses, when we're honest with God, then we recognize when we've moved from genuine struggle to excuses. And we give up our excuses. God calls us, God empowers us, God equips us at that point to do what he calls us to do. God calls us to do the impossible. But he empowers us to do the impossible. We cannot do it when excuses are wrapped around us, when we're dragging around a bag of excuses every time something comes up. We're like, oh, no, I can't because, here you go. All right. If there's a genuine reason you can't do something, it's a genuine reason. But if there's an excuse in it, God says, you got to lay that down. Be done with excuses, step up to the plate, and then I can do something with you. The song they sang, and I have Milton just lead us in the chorus again. I think we know it. It's as we respond to him, as we walk with him, and as we lay down our excuses. You've heard the phrase, those who are good at making excuses are rarely good for anything else. Yeah, that's pretty much accurate. Even in the spiritual life. So as we stand this morning, whatever there is God's asking you to do, calling you to do, whether it be a ministry, whether it be an area of life to surrender to him, whatever it is, he will help you do it. He will empower you to do it. But we have to drop the excuses. Hold on to the honesty, drop the excuses first. And then God can turn us into someone that future generations can look to and see the grace of God in our lives. Go ahead and lead us if you would.